Welcome to Straight Thinking, a GPS for the Christian mind, teaching you how to think, not what to think. This is Average Joe Aguirre with theologian and philosopher Kenneth Samples and physicist Dave Rogstad. On today's podcast, where did human rights come from? Ken, we might take human rights for granted, but humanity has not always enjoyed such privileges, correct?
That's exactly right. And today we talk a lot about human rights. We talk about human dignity. Christians, of course, would ground those things in the image of God. We're made in God's image and therefore have inherent dignity and moral worth. But other worldviews have a lot harder time grounding that idea. And today I'd like to talk about this topic because December 10th, 2018, which is just a couple months ago, there was the 70th anniversary of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights by the United Nations. That was a big deal. And I'd like to read a little bit from that and talk about how we can ground human rights and how people around the world think about the idea of the dignity of human beings.
So, Ken, for the sake of context, would this have been after the Second World War and the atrocities that occurred? Is that
That's
how this
right.
came about?
So this is 1948. The Second World War has been over just a couple years. Israel has become a nation. Western Europe is being rebuilt from the rubble of the bombings. 70 million people may have perished in that war. So this is a time in which people are reevaluating what does it mean to be a human being, and where do human beings get their dignity, and can it be taken from them by totalitarian dictatorships? So I want to read a little bit from the Declaration, talk a little bit about worldviews and how Christianity views some of these things.
Terrific.
Well, here is a little introductory article to the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. It says, given the rivalries and violence that divided the global communities today, it's hard to imagine that on December 10, 1948, the nations of the world approved almost unanimously a detailed list of fundamental rights that every human on the planet should enjoy. The Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the most sweeping such statement ever endorsed on a worldwide basis, opened by asserting all human beings are born free and equal in dignity and rights. It proceeded with 30 articles summarizing the things to which everyone should be entitled in a world of genuine peace and justice. In the immediate aftermath of the two horrifying world wars, not a single member state of the newly created United Nations dared oppose the declaration, though several nations abstained on the final vote, and so many of the rights remain unachieved on its 70th anniversary, testifies to the boundless idealism of the document's drafters. Well, let's again remember the context of this. 6 million Jews had perished in the Holocaust. Millions of people had died in the Pacific under the totalitarian regime of the Empire of Japan. This was a time, and I remember my dad telling me as a boy that when his infantry unit finally got into Berlin, you couldn't find an intact building. It was just rubble everywhere. So, you know, you have the need to rebuild civilization, and this is the context of which the atheistic existentialists say, is there any meaning to life? What do you mean meaning and purpose? Look at Western civilization has been destroyed. And so where do human beings get dignity and value? And it's in the backdrop of that the United Nations came to be. And of course, the purpose was maybe if nations talk to each other, maybe they won't need to go to war with one another. Maybe we can pursue these kinds of things. And as I've said on earlier podcasts, I think World War II is just enormously important in terms of all the things that come out of it. But one of them is this question, in light of these two terrible world wars, and the murder of millions of people, How can we say that human beings have dignity, that they have freedom and value, and people ought to respect them? There are totalitarian regimes that have no sense of people having dignity. They walk on them if they need to. Here is a couple of the statements. The preamble reads this way: whereas recognition of the inherent dignity and of the equal and inalienable rights of all members of human family is the foundation of freedom, justice, and peace in the world. And here's Article 1. There are 30 articles. I won't read all of them, just a select few. It says, all human beings are born free and equal in dignity and rights. They are endowed with reason and conscience and should act towards one another in a spirit of brotherhood. That is an amazing statement. Let me read it again. All human beings are born free and equal in dignity and rights. They're endowed with reason and conscience and should act towards one another in a spirit of brotherhood. Here's the second article. Everyone is entitled to all the rights and freedoms set forth in this declaration without discrimination of any kind, such as race, color, sex, language, religion, political or other opinion, national and social origin, property, birth, or other status. Furthermore, no distinction shall be made on the basis of the political, jurisdictional or international status of the country or territory to which a person belongs, whether it be independent, trust, non-self-governing, and under any limitation of sovereignty. Wow, this is idealism. This is a mega presentation of the dignity of people. Article 3, everyone has the right to life, liberty, and the security of person. Article 4, no one shall be held in slavery or servitude. Slavery and the slave trade shall be prohibited in all their forms. Article 5, no one shall be subjected to torture or to cruel, inhumane, or degrading treatment or punishment. Article 6, everyone has the right to recognition everywhere as a person before the law. This is an amazing statement. Eleanor Roosevelt, by the way, was one of the leading presenters of this. The wife of, at that point, Franklin Roosevelt had passed away 1945, right before the war ended, but his wife Eleanor had been involved in helping the United Nations develop, and she was one of the people leading this focus on the dignity of human beings. Well, I can't tell you how much I agree with this, that human beings have inherent dignity, moral worth, that they have rights, that those rights should not be trampled on by other individuals. But now the question that I have is, of course, how would you ground those rights? I mean, just prior to that, there have been a whole lot of people who say, we don't think you have any of those rights, and even if you do, we couldn't care less. So in the light of totalitarian regimes, how do you ground all of that? Well, this article talks just a bit more about the groups that oppose the declaration. Oh. It says, not surprisingly, the declaration stirred some controversy at the time. Despite its adoption without overt opposition and resistance, its sweep has only increased in the last 7 decades. Among the 8 countries that abstained on the final vote were the Soviet Union and the 5 Soviet bloc nations that were UN members at the time, South Africa, whose apartheid regime could not stomach any declaration concerning racial discrimination, also abstained. So did Saudi Arabia, claiming some rights listed in the declaration were not consistent with Islamic law. Some U.S. conservatives made their own unease with the declaration, seeing it as an assertion of broad economic rights to a step towards socialism. The Soviets had objection to the declaration, arguing that it favored individual over collective rights and undermined national sovereignty. Mm. Now, what were some of the sources that were appealed to? The Magna Carta, the U.S. Declaration of Independence, the Bill of Rights. But I'm going to do them one better, the Judeo-Christian Bible. The idea that human beings have inherent dignity and moral worth, how do we ground that idea? And let's explore that a little bit historically. What would the ancient Greeks and Romans say about inherent dignity and moral worth? You have none. If you're a Roman citizen, you have rights. But if you're not, you have no rights at all. In the Greco-Roman world, slavery was very, very significant. Not just anybody has rights. It's when you're a citizen of Caesar's kingdom, then we'll give you rights. But most people had no rights.
Wow.
Let's talk about atheistic evolutionary naturalism. Peter Singer. Let me introduce Peter Singer to you. Peter Singer is a world-class philosopher and ethicist. He is a professor at Princeton University, which was one of the great Christian schools in American history. That's the school that produced Benjamin Warfield and Charles Hodge and many other great Christian thinkers. Well, Australian philosopher Peter Singer, a bioethicist at Princeton University, he has some very interesting things to say about ethics and human rights. In fact, he argues this. He says, Singer rejects all religious foundations for ethics. He promotes a utilitarian ethic, the greatest good for the greatest number. He's an outspoken advocate for late-term abortions, infanticide in the first month of life, active euthanasia for the elderly, and even bestiality. He says that that parents ought to have 2 years to decide whether they want to kill their child or not. And here's a quote from him. He says, I have argued that the life of a fetus, and even more plainly of an embryo, is of no greater value than the life of a non-human animal at a similar level of rationality, self-awareness, capacity to feel, and so on, and that because no fetus is a person, no fetus has the same claim to life as a person. Now, this isn't just anybody. This is a professor of ethics at Princeton University.
Yeah.
I will give some credit to Peter Singer. He's not afraid to defend his worldview.
Right.
He comes right out and says, look, we're all evolved animals, and human babies, they're not as conscious as chicks and farm animals, and you can't give them the same rights.
Yeah. You mentioned in the last podcast on lifelong learning that YouTube videos are a source of information. You can find Singer on YouTube, as I have. I kind of stumbled across it, and you're not making this up.
No.
It's there in context. So,
yeah, in fact, he condemns...
And he's an in-demand speaker, too,
by the way, he debates Christian apologists. He argues against God. He argues for a naturalist worldview. And could I say, he's a formidable individual. To try to give him some credibility in terms of taking him on, I think he's trying to live consistent with his worldview. A lot of times atheists back away from the implications of their worldview. At least Peter Singer comes out and says, look, we're all animals. Come on, get over it. Mm. He condemns speciesism. And so the idea that human beings have unique aspects of them that give us dignity, he rejects that idea. So where do we ground these rights? When we talk about inherent dignity and moral worth, all humans are born free and equal in dignity and rights, are endowed with reason and conscience, and should act towards one another in a spirit of brotherhood. Well, look, if God created human beings in his image, and that image reflects the very nature of the Creator, then we have a grounding. God is ultimate truth. He is the ultimate reality. He has made people in his image. And of course, in a biblical context, if you take the life of another human being, according to the Old Testament, Genesis 9, your life can be taken by the government. A life for a life. In the New Testament, it also mentions that we're made in the image of God, and it even says, be careful about slurs. Be careful about stating negative things about people's character, because you may be touching an area that is a deep offense. Mm. So this idea that human beings have inherent dignity and moral worth, it seems to me that this is a very rare idea. We don't find it among the pagan nations. We don't find it even among the advanced civilization of the Romans and the Greeks. We don't find it in naturalism. I mean, if life is the product of blind mechanistic processes, who are we to say that human beings have inherent dignity and moral worth? Now, don't get me wrong. I think the vast majority of atheists would agree that human beings have inherent dignity and moral worth.
That's why they can sign up to a document like this.
That's right. But now the question is, according to their worldview, how do they justify it? How do they ground it?
Are you suggesting at this point that they're borrowing Christian capital or Judeo-Christian capital without admitting it?
I am. Okay. I am arguing that, Joe. In fact, what I want to say is that in the Greco-Roman world, there is no inherent dignity and moral worth. You know, if you're a parent and you want to throw your kids away, you know, the babies, throw them out on, just neglect them. Those babies have no rights. If you're a slave, let's go further. If you're a woman in the Greco-Roman world, you don't have the rights that males do. I've said this before, I'll say it again. Two largest people group to become Christians almost immediately, slaves and women. Because Jesus relates to women like no other religious leader. He talks with them, they become disciples of his. He appears to women in the resurrection. He grants them dignity. He doesn't treat them as scapegoats in terms of sexuality. If you compare that to the way the Buddha, Confucius, Muhammad treated women, there's no comparison. This is one of the many ways in which Jesus is uncomparable in terms of his kind of moral dignity. I would even raise the question about a worldview where there is no God. So let's talk a little bit about this idea of the roots of human rights being found in Christianity. You know, Christianity initially doesn't have a lot of power. If you go back to the first and second century, most of the time Christians are trying to keep from getting persecuted and killed. They don't have a real collective influence on society. They're trying to make disciples. They don't even take time to write out all the biblical books. They're trying to convince people to accept Jesus as the Messiah. That's the Great Commission. And they're trying to stay alive. And so some of the early apologists, Justin Martyr, they're trying to argue with the Greco-Roman government, hey, look, we're not immoral people. We're not criminals. We're not worthy of this kind of persecution. We're good citizens. We love our brothers and sisters. But slowly, by the time Constantine comes along in the fourth century, then the Christian church starts to get some power. The Christian church starts to influence society. It starts to call the shots. And so slowly and gradually, Christianity, or if I can be more theologically precise, Nicene Orthodoxy becomes the official religion of the Roman Empire.
It's interesting how the very act that brought about what you're saying is also the act that brought about the church bringing corruption into the church, because now you could become a church leader and have power in the state.
That's right. And of course, there is a whole load of charges and challenges that are made about Christian persons and groups in church history who either committed atrocities mm-hmm. or didn't do enough to stop various things. But it's only with the church reaching a place where it could begin to transform society. So, you know, it's a pretty amazing thing that in 500 years, paganism disappears. It's basically swallowed up by Christianity. The pagan nations are overwhelmed by the Christian life and worldview. And not only does Nicene Orthodoxy become the theology of the period, but the religion, the empire, becomes a Christian empire. So when Rome is sacked by Alaric and the Visigoths, who were, by the way, Arian in their Christology, you know, the Christians are, oh my goodness, our once Roman Empire and now Christian Empire is, you know, falling to pieces. But it is in the Middle Ages where there is social change, and Christians begin to use the power that they have to oppose slavery, to oppose prostitution, to oppose neglect for the poor. You know, there are all kinds of elements here that come out of a Christian worldview. Hospice. The early Christians in the ancient world, they realized, you know, people get sick and they're dying, and we can't cure them, but we can care for them. We can have hospitals to help people who are on the edge.
Ken, I don't know if you want to address this now or if you're going to get to it a little bit later, but sometimes the person from a skeptical perspective, atheistic perspective, would say it's the Enlightenment that really brought all this upon humanity. That's where things emerged from the Dark Ages. You're saying, as you've been describing for the last 15 minutes, no, it's tracing back to the Christian scriptures.
Absolutely. The building of hospitals, the building of orphanages, the building of hospice centers, the desire to build a health net. You know, I mean, we live in the modern world. We have things like Medicare. We have things like Social Security. We have food stamps. We have various ways in which people who are on the edge can get some help, hopefully putting them over so that they can move on with their lives. In the ancient world, none of that existed. Christians were known for sharing their food. The scientific enterprise began in the Middle Ages with these Christian universities. Education was advanced by the monks studying in the monasteries. This is long before the Enlightenment. And by the way, Joe, the first era of the Enlightenment was religious. So the Enlightenment is not purely a secular movement at all. And again, this is grounded in the idea that the Christians have a different worldview. They share it with their Jewish friends. Although Christians and Jews have not always gotten along, and sometimes Jews have been the worse for that, the reality is that the Christians accepted the Jewish scriptures. And this idea was that human beings did have dignity and value. So you shouldn't cuss people out. You shouldn't speak of them in harsh manner, because the image they bear is God's image. And if you take that life, then as Anthony Hukama, a Reformed theologian, says, if you take the life of a human being without just cause, you're attacking God, because that's God's image. This is the foundation of that idea that human beings have human rights, that they have dignity, that it's grounded in creation, that it's connected to God himself. And how do we sort that out if we don't have it? The pagan nations, believe me, two of my favorite philosophers are Plato and Aristotle. I love the Greek philosophers. They have a hard time grounding the kind of dignity that Aristotle would give to men, not to women. they have a hard time giving a rational justification for that. Peter Singer, modern atheism. Look, I think the naturalist worldview has struggles with explanatory power and scope. I think there are a number of things they have a hard time grounding, justifying, that there's an ultimate meaning to life. I think they wrestle with that. That there's an objective morality. I think that they wrestle with that. How do we account for truth, goodness, and rationality? How can I guarantee that humans are rational creatures when the source that stands behind their cognitive faculties is not rational itself?
Now, how does a Peter Singer ground his belief that at least adult utilitarian people who have some value?
I think he would say that there is a certain point in human cognitive development where a person now has awareness and consciousness, and they have the qualities of personhood that exhibit themselves so that people should be treated with respect. But he's not going to, he's going to think abortion is okay. He's going to think, Joe, that when the elderly get dementia, they've lost these rights. And he's going to argue that we need to, in reality, and by the way, I write about all of this in two chapters in my book, Seven Truths That Changed the World, where I talk about the image of God and how powerful it has transformed society. But I essentially say Peter Singer is a revisit to Friedrich Nietzsche. Nietzsche lived in the 19th century. By the way, Dave, Nietzsche said he could never forget the first time he heard Handel's Messiah. He said it haunted him his whole life. Well, Nietzsche was German. His father was a Lutheran minister. His father died a really tough disease. Nietzsche was angry at God, gave up belief in God. Nietzsche said, you know, we have a real problem. Our civilization, the civilization of the Western world, is built on Christianity. But he says the intellectuals don't believe it anymore. And he said, we're in real trouble because our foundation is Christian ethics, but Christianity is false. Mm. We don't have justification for human dignity and value. And that was his argument.
How would he... Here's a mother who has a child, and that child, say, gets some disease at the age of, you know, maybe a heart problem after, you know, they've been around for a month. She has love for this child, grieves over the child if a child dies. Would he say that the mother is being ridiculous or silly because she's placing value in this child that really doesn't have any value?
Well, I'll tell you a true story. Of course, Peter Singer's mother got older, and she suffered with dementia.
Okay.
And Peter Singer couldn't pull the plug. I'm being crass, but he couldn't apply his evolutionary ethic to his own mother. And I think that's the point we need to come back to. I think the point is secularists believe in the dignity of human beings. Most people.
Right.
I mean, there's always a psychopath
who
doesn't think in a rational manner about human dignity.
But reasonable people.
But secular people, they value human life. They see dignity in that life. And so the question is not, are these atheists are bad people because they can't believe in objective morality? That's not the issue at all.
Right.
The real issue is, I think, to go back to Nietzsche. If Western civilization is essentially built on Christian truth claims, and you can no longer believe in the truth of Christianity, well, then can you still believe in the Sermon on the Mount? Can you still believe love your neighbor? Mm-hmm. Can you still believe in the image of God if God doesn't exist? And so the question then does come, how do we ground? Or are we just being sentimental? I think Nietzsche, I think Singer would probably look at someone like you've described, Dave, and say, at some point you have to give up your sentimentality, although he couldn't when it came to his own mother.
Right.
And thank God he couldn't. Mm. But the question is, this is a powerful statement about human rights that emerges from the United Nations that speaks of the dignity and the value of human beings. And the reality is we have a whole world after the World War, with a few exceptions, who went against it. The Soviets and some of the Islamic nations had trouble with it. And some Americans were troubled because they thought this is pushing socialism. It's not that they differed with the idea of the dignity of man, but they thought this is tied to a political view I may not be accepting of. But nevertheless, the world said it's wrong what Hitler did to the Jews. It's wrong what the Japanese did to the Chinese. It's these world wars cannot stand because the next world war will be a nuclear war. And so we have to come and say children that are sick and hungry and naked need to be cared for. People who are older, who can no longer take care of themselves, they need to be comforted and cared for. There needs to be a safety net. We need to be our brother's keeper. How do we do it? I would say all of those things are rooted in a worldview that comes out of the Bible. Now, do Christians always live up to those standards? No. I mean, one of the challenges of being a Christian is we have these incredible moral ideals, and yet sanctification is this long and difficult process. It is trying to live up to the ideals. Houston Smith, one of the great scholars of the world's religions, he said Jesus is a very strange bird. He said not only did Jesus preach the Sermon on the Mount, he lived it. Well, I'm going to differ with some of my Christian friends. I don't think any of us can live the Sermon on the Mount. I think if you did, you wouldn't need a redeemer. I think a lot of Jesus' preaching is, you better repent because you can't meet God's standard. You need a Savior. I think that that's a critical part of it. But of course, part of that sanctification is then looking to the third use of the law. The law condemns me, but now I can get around to it and say, how can I use the law as a means of loving my brother and working towards this? And so I know it's kind of common at times for Christians to say that other civilizations, other worldviews are borrowing biblical Christian capital, but I do think that that's the case. And I think that if you take God away from ethics, it's a glass house. It's going to break. We need some kind of metaphysical, some transcendent basis upon which to build this ethical view. And if God exists, and that God is the God of the Bible, then objective ethics, I think, can have a foundation. But, you know, we need to come back to this and say we find this very attractive. Now let me take a different tact for a moment, if I could. I was at an ISCA conference. This is the International Society for Christian Apologetics. I think it was in Georgia. And there was a speaker. He was a Baptist philosopher, theologian, and I have to remember his name, but he gave a very interesting talk. He essentially in his talk said there's two types of unbelievers, intellectual unbelievers today. He said one type is a person who says that, you know, there is some rational basis for Christianity, but I don't want to believe it. You know, there may be some substance to these arguments for the existence of God or for the truth of Christian truth claims, but essentially the unbeliever says, yeah, there's some basis for it rationally. That is, you have to argue with them, but I don't want that God to exist. I don't want him. Mm-hmm. He then said there was another type of unbeliever, and that is the person who says, you know, when I read St. Augustine or I read C.S. Lewis or I read the Sermon on the Mount, I kind of wonder, maybe it actually would be good if there was this God, this providential hand, this God who's described as a God of love. I'm open to that type of God, but I just don't see any rational basis for it at all. It's mythology. And it struck me that here is this Christian thinker who says there are two types of atheists, two types of unbelievers. One says, I don't want this God to exist, even though I have a hard time arguing with Alvin Plantinga or Hugh Ross or any of these other apologists, but I don't want that God. And then there's the other type who says, you know, I kind of would like to believe it's just mythology, though. There's no rational basis for it. This, of course, has raised the question, and I'm going to lay it out there for our listeners. Is it possible that we need to have an apologetic, not for just the truthfulness of Christianity, but an apologetic that reminds people how good it is? The reason I say that is I've been doing apologetics professionally for more than 30 years. So my first professional job doing apologetics, I worked at the Christian Research Institute with Walter Martin. In 1987, I would be invited to go out to a public college or university, and almost always there would be questions about the existence of God, the resurrection, essentially, the question centered on the idea of, is Christianity true? Now, let me move forward in the future, back to 2017, which puts 30 years later.
Yeah.
Now I go out to a university or a college audience working for Hugh Ross and Reasons to Believe, and a lot of the students ask me a very different question. Instead of asking me whether Christianity is true, they often ask me, is Christianity good? Has it been good for minorities? Has it been good for women? Has Christianity really given us the kind of society that we want? And I was thinking, wow, those are very different. Don't get me wrong, there's still plenty of students who ask me about the truth of the Christian faith, but they raise different kinds of questions. They want to know, why weren't Christians more adamant against slavery? Why did it take so long for women to have more opportunities in this so-called Christian Western civilization? So now I raise the question here. Is it possible in light of 70 years of a presentation concerning human dignity and human rights, is it possible that we have to remind everybody what an attractive worldview Christian theism really is? Do we have to go back and say, you know, we need to apologize by saying we're sorry that we haven't lived up to this Christian worldview, that we have made mistakes, that I've made mistakes, Christians before me have made mistakes, but let me remind you of the Christian worldview. Let me remind you of what the Christian worldview says about the dignity and value of human beings. Let me also remind you that the church might fail you and I might fail you, but Jesus Christ will never fail you. Let me introduce him to you. Let me expose you to the sermons that he preached. Let me talk about the truth of him overcoming. You know, I just recently wrote an article on my blog about fear and courage. And I mentioned there have been a few times I've been afraid in my life, and I don't like to admit when I'm afraid. In fact, sometimes I like being angry because when I'm angry, I don't feel fear. So I'll project anger to keep me from showing my fear and insecurity. There are certain psychologies that come out of the mind of Ken. Well, let me say that death is a reality that we all face. We don't like talking about it. In fact, I like to talk about it because I'm trying to get over it. I'm hoping that maybe I won't always feel so afraid of it. But the reality is that even with transhumanism and all the claims that transhumanism makes, people are going to die, and they're going to die soon. And if there's no God, they're going to die alone, and they're going to be dead forever, unless Christianity is true. Because Jesus is publicly crucified, and on Sunday morning, what we call the Lord's Day, by the way, every Sunday is the Lord's Day. Every Sunday is a celebration of Easter. That's why we meet on that day. It had no Jewish significance, but it has Christian significance because the Son of God came out of the tomb. If Jesus Christ conquered death, if he survived death, if he's resurrected, and the New Testament says that more than 500 people witnessed it, all kinds of different people saw him, interacted with him. If Jesus Christ conquered death, then there's nothing more important for a person to hear than the story of Jesus' life, death, and resurrection. And is it possible we have to reintroduce people to the Christian worldview that says those scared, hungry, naked kids, they need to be taken care of. God loves them. Those older folks who can't remember who their daughter or son is any longer, they have dignity and value. Those kids who have Down syndrome, they still have the image of God, and they have value. And if we're going to have objective ethics, if we're going to have a world where humans have dignity, we need a metaphysical ground for it. Dave, jump in.
Just one thing that struck me when you point out these sort of two different responses from your students. What they're doing is they're testing according to two different criteria. One was whether it's true. Do I accept Christianity because it's true?
Yeah.
The other was
is it good?
The criterion was, I don't know whether it's true or not, but is it good? Jesus says the criterion that hereby will men know that you're my disciples and that you love one another. And it's that love that is going to be ultimately the criteria that provides the truth. And that's intimately tied just to what you're talking about here, how we treat other people.
Yeah, yeah. I think if you introduce people to Jesus, I think Jesus is the ultimate apologetic. I mean, I love all the classical arguments. I don't know if there's a Christian argument that I don't like. Even if I'm critical of it, I wanna try to go back and evaluate it. I think when you introduce people to Jesus Christ, when you hear him preach, when you see the way he treats people, when you see statements, in fact, when I was reading this declaration, I immediately thought to myself, I feel like I'm reading the book of Galatians, no difference between Jew, Gentile, slave, free, male, female, all are one in Jesus Christ. Mm-hmm. When I read through this, I thought, wow, I'm reading Christian ethics.
Yeah.
This is Christian Ethics 101. Mm-hmm. So is it possible that part of the apologetic claim is to go back and remind people about what the Christian vision of life is? I mean, we have a great story. We have a great vision about the dignity of human beings. We have an explanatory. There's creation, fall, redemption, destiny or consummation. We have a powerful story that has explanatory power and scope. You know, is it possible we have to go back and remind people of that and then give them a taste for it? I mean, I think C.S. Lewis in some ways first was attracted to Christianity before he thought it was true. Could it be that I want this to be true? You know, at first he thought, I'm kind of a reluctant convert, right? But then later, he starts to see the value of it. Here's what I want to read just a paragraph from my book, Seven Truths. I say the image, the Imago Dei lays the foundation for the sacredness of human life. This image makes human life unrepeatable and worthy of reverence. All people, regardless of race, sex, class, age, standing, health, appearance, or other distinctions, deserve respect and dignified treatment as the crown of creation. Even people with limited mental capacities and various other physical handicaps are made in God's image and therefore possess immeasurable worth. Though physical conditions may keep them from reflecting all of God's endowments in the usual way, this by no means diminishes their inherent dignity and value as human beings. This is the Christian capital. This is the view that human beings do have dignity, that we have no right to torture people. We have no right to kidnap people. You know, we have a huge problem in various parts of the world when it comes to human trafficking. I mean, the thought that somebody would kidnap one of my daughters and then subject them to unending sexual abuse. I mean, steam comes out of my ears even thinking about something like that. That's a casual experience in many places in the world. Mm-hmm. So again, this idea that, wait a second, you know, Walter Martin debated the founder of Playboy, Hefner,
Hugh Hefner.
I was always proud of Walter Martin. He took on all comers. He was the General Patton of apologetics. But he debated Hugh Hefner on one of the New York programs back in the days when he lived in New York. And Walter asked him, well, what about your daughter? Would it be okay for your daughter to become a playmate? And Walter told Hugh Hefner, every woman is somebody's daughter. You know, when you think about things like that, the dignity of human beings, the dignity of women needs to be protected. It needs to be understood that they reflect the glory of their maker. And I think that that's a very powerful worldview, and I think that my atheist friends are right. Human beings do have inherent dignity and moral worth. It's just their worldview cannot ground it and justify it.
Yeah. Ken, a quick question as we get to the end of the podcast. Obviously, there are places around the world, as you've been discussing, that don't abide by these articles, and you only mentioned 6 of 30 that we could have talked about.
That's right, yeah.
But these are being violated all the time. What is the response on the part of the atheist? Because a lot of times people who are bent towards a type of atheism will say, that's relative to that culture, so whatever is good over there, they don't have to adopt our American or Western values, so let that be. I don't think that would be the case. I think they would be alarmed at what's going on around the world. So how do they respond if the UN articles are correct? Because you're talking about this grounding after all.
Yeah, I think there are a couple thoughts that run through my mind, Joe. Number one, I would say, I don't think people immediately recognize that there's a difference between believing in an objective morality and then the necessary work to justify or ground it. I think some people don't appreciate that yeah, virtually all of us believe in the dignity of human beings, but does a world without God where we're the product of blind evolutionary chance give us any basis for justifying it? Would the Romans and the Greeks, what would they think about it? So sometimes people don't see that you can believe in something, but that doesn't mean that you can actually justify it or defend it based upon your view of the nature of reality or metaphysic. I think the other thing is a lot of times the secularist thinks it's the religious worldviews over there that complicate and contaminate and all these kinds of things. I think sometimes an atheist wants to have the freedom of God not existing, but wants to keep the moral barriers in place. I just think that that's a problem. I think Nietzsche saw it. that our civilization, right or wrong, is built on Christian ethics. But if you get rid of the Christian God, why do the ethics have any significance whatsoever? Of course, some of the groups at the time, the Soviets, protested this kind of belief. And of course, today we have the United Nations. We have nations like China. We have nations like Russia. We have nations like Iran. We have nations like North Korea. And they ignore these kinds of things quite readily. But, you know, I would bring us back and say that maybe there is a special need for a two-tiered apologetic, one arguing for the very truthfulness of the Christian worldview, and the other how superior it is to its competitors.
That's right.
All right, great stuff, Ken.
Some sources here.
Yes.
I want to encourage you to, if you'd like to go on the web, you can go to the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and this declaration will pop up. You can read the 30 articles. A few months ago, there were plenty of articles out there describing it. If you'd like to hear my discussion of human rights in light of the image of God, Seven Truths That Changed the World has two chapters on the topic. And there are a lot of really good material being written about human dignity and moral worth, defending pro-life positions, talking about, I mean, in my book, I talk about the trouble of abortion and euthanasia, that these, you know, we don't let people get born and you better not get old. What a troubling situation that is. And so Christian apologetics isn't just arguing for truth, it's also arguing for virtue.
Excellent. Great way to end a podcast. Thank you very much for your thoughts on that. Ken's blog is reflectionsbyken.wordpress.com. You can find an article there each week. For Ken Samples and Dave Rogstad, this is Joe Aguirre with a reminder that the goal of apologetics is not victory but truth. Thanks for listening and join us for the next edition of Straight Thinking.
Thank you for listening. Your prayers and financial support are reaching people with reasons for faith in Jesus Christ, our Creator and Savior. To allow Reasons to Believe programs like this to continue, make your gift today at reasons.org.